Untitled love poem. Along our path that splices those fields like shared fruit, we discover gnat-touched tracks and little fires of wildflowers. Fat leaves filled with green, mockingbirds and jays swell their chests, scatter as we near. A circle of crows call for more, more, more. Large oaks and maples sigh, the breath of clouds, the stretch of lily and tulip, morning blooms, June's joy. Delight despite the heavy heat, thick with thyme and insects, where squirrels scurry, searching for the buried harvest, with everything full of song, pollen's siren. When I stop to stare, mid-sentence, mid-move, as you sweep a dead toad from our path, with grace so light, like when we danced to the radio, songs with baby grands and horns, songs no longer played, seasonal as these beats, as these feet, the moment's morning treat, these hands, this touch, this love.
Welcome to Poets Cafe. Thank you for coming, Matthew.
Thank you.
We're here in the cafe. I'm Lois P. Jones. We're here with our special guest, Matthew Silverman. He's the editor and founder of Blue Lyra Review, and he's a review editor of Museum of Americana. He's also on the board of 32 Poems and is a reader for Spark Wheel Press. I'll mention your chapbook, too, The Breath Before Birds Fly, is out right now on ELJ Press. And your poems have appeared in many, many fine journals.
Thank you.
Yes. We connected through the Tupelo Press 3030 project.
It's a great project.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit what that is about?
Well, it's a fundraiser for an independent press called Tupelo Press, which hopefully everyone knows. If not, you should definitely check that
Everybody
out.
Everybody knows, yeah.
Yes. Jeffrey Levine does a great job over there, as well as the staff. And what they do is have people write a poem a day for 30 days, and during that time, it's sort of like a running marathon where people would send a little amount of money, or you can subscribe on behalf of that poet who is writing and working for 30 days.
Right, a running marathon. Actually, so yeah, it's like, okay.
You know. But it's a great marathon. You could have a beer in your hand and be in your underwear, you know. So.
That's right. Just collect the funds. Right. And it's really, how did you find the challenge? Was this the first time you'd ever done something like this, write a poem a day, or had you done it before?
Well, there are several groups that do poems a day during April for Poetry Month, and I've done it before, but it felt a lot more pressure when there was money on the line.
You know? Right? So. Money on the line and a really good name.
It's right.
Like, people are going to be looking at this every day.
Right. You're not just workshopping it. You're also posting it online so people can see and comment. So
that's right.
You know.
And Kirsten Miles, who is heavily involved in the project, is doing a lot to get more and more non-poets involved in reading the work, too, which I think is great.
She's a miracle worker.
She is a miracle worker, yeah. And they just keep going from great project to great project. So how did you keep yourself inspired? Did you have, like, a specific focus when you were doing it? You know, I'm going to write on love poems or something, or I'm going to – you just – what did you do to sort of get yourself in the mood, in the mode?
Well, that's a good question. They encourage you to do some sort of theme, because then you can also turn it into a manuscript. And I sort of took a roundabout way, because I couldn't pin myself down to a theme at the time. Working for Blue Lyra Review, which is my magazine, and several other projects, working on the Bloomsbury Anthology, I just wanted to kind of get out there and do it. So I just chose every poem to be untitled. And then that was my theme.
Yeah, the generic generation. Right. But of course, they're beautiful. I mean, that's the first poem that you read was from inspired during the 30-30 process,
right.
Correct?
Yes.
And I didn't write on a theme either. I had never done it before. So it's hard,
right.
You know, and then every day is like, I'll be at midnight, you know, posting my poem, and I'm like, whew, one day's down, but then you get the whole, you know, runway before you again, so really a challenge.
Several writers have managed to, like Anthony Frame and others, have managed to turn those things into a manuscript that's been published since they've done the 30-30, so it can be a really great opportunity.
Yeah, it's very seminal.
Focus yourself on, like, I guess me and you.
Right, who are dispersed in 50 million different right. directions.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it's a great project. And, you know, some of the, do you think, like one of the great poets, for example, Rainer Maria Rilke wrote the sonnets to Orpheus in like 3 weeks, right? So do you think it's possible to write in that context, you know, some of your best work? I mean, is there, or do you feel that time is more essential in being able to bring it to its fruition?
I guess it depends on how, the kind of drugs you have. No,
like Bukowski, you know, yeah, drinking alcohol every day.
You hear about all the people who, you know, would be on some kind of drug trance and then they wrote something, you know, obviously the famous poem where they're knocking on the door and interrupted the poem and then you couldn't finish Kubla Khan. But, you know, I tend to just, whenever I get inspired by something, and it tends to be while I'm reading or listening to music, mm-hmm. and then that sort of kind of takes me down a different path. So I don't think that for me I can do like 3 weeks and turn into a manuscript. You know, I went to a Coleraine conference where we worked on manuscripts, and one of the people—
Is that also with Tupelo?
Tupelo's involved. I mean, Jeffrey Levine does go from time to time, but it's through Joan and Fred have mostly kind of done that on their own, and it's a really kind of great opportunity too to just kind of work on the manuscript, and they have a couple like ideas for like generating ideas and mm-hmm. But it's good to just kind of focus on, and they have a nice little way of working on like the beginning, middle, and end and kind of organizing it. And several people have gone on to get published after the Coleraine. They have like up to 100 manuscripts that have been published since people attended.
Wow, so that's a good stat.
Not to plug that as well, too, but I guess I am.
Let's plug it all. Let's plug everything. You know, this is a poetry show. And we're here today with our wonderful guest, Matthew Silverman, who's visiting us from Georgia and has come out here for actually a special reading at the Skirball. And you are in part also involved with the... It's Bloomsbury. It's a contemporary anthology of Jewish poetry, correct?
Right. The Bloomsbury Anthology of Contemporary Jewish American Poetry was something that Deborah Asher and I just sort of started corresponding. She had someone on her staff interview me and for 32 poems, and I said, well, you know, I'd really love to be in a Jewish poetry anthology. You know, I noticed there hasn't been one on the market for over 15 years.
Yeah.
And then she said, why don't we just do it? Uh-huh. And then, you know, 2 years later, Bloomsbury picked it up, and we have over 110 poets. But we're doing readings all over the nation. We had two or three in New York, several in San Francisco. We had one in Vegas at the Holocaust Center. And so we're kind of really trying to spread it and help get attention to Jewish poetry. And that's really been the whole goal.
Do you think it's well represented? I mean, is it... Do some journals, are journals open to taking poetry on Jewish themes in general, do you think, or have we to kind of work toward that?
Well, there are magazines just dedicated to looking for Jewish poetry, mm-hmm. and then there's certain places where you can just submit only Jewish poetry, but our anthology is more broader focused. You know,
okay.
You don't have to be even writing on a Jewish topic. We have some people who are secular, some people who are not.
Oh, okay.
East Coast, West Coast. We have some people from the LG community, you know, just all different types of people. And they're not always writing on, like, you know, the Bubby poem or the Jewish
right.
poem or the Holocaust poem,
yeah.
you know, where some things tend to come out. They're just writing, and, you know, you can just appreciate the experience of just being human rather than being Jewish by reading it. And as far as, like, having more people, I mean, I think it's pretty widespread as it is, but there are so many people we had to exclude because, you know, we have 300 pages, you know.
Right. So, you can only fit in so many
right,
poems.
Only fit so much. So there's at least 150 more we could probably include. So it's
it's a great, you know, project to have those different views brought together. Do you have the book with you, by the way? I didn't ask you to bring it, so don't worry.
No,
I just kind of wanted to have a look at it, but
yeah, it's
I'm
in
sure
my car.
Quick, we'll go look at it. That's all right. But I know that you too have you're kind of with three running themes. You know, one of them is Noah. And
in my own writing,
yes,
right.
In your own writing, yes. And The Last Jew, is that a second one?
And Yeah, I tend to have three themes. One is a modern-day Noah. I just imagine like a character who may or may not be Noah plunked down into modern society.
Right.
And another one where the actual last Jew in Afghanistan is just something that interests me. I mean, you know, to be one Jew in a whole country must be very challenging, especially when your family has already gone to Israel over a decade ago. And then the last thing I tend to write about is my own Jewish family, but I tend to have like a touch of magical realism kind of thrown into it. So I would have like shoes that kind of fly up, or, you know, a mother as a menorah, you know, my sister is a dreidel. So it kind of has, a little twist to it.
Well, let's get into some of your own poems here from your book, The Breath Before Birds. You have a wonderful Noah poem. I love the idea of it, but I'll let you read it.
Sure. It's called Noah Shops for an Ark. After God asks, Noah, not bothering to dress, goes to Lowe's. He wanders aisles, past tubes and buckets, pails and bulbs, stacks of pipes, sheets of colorful metal. He spots a clerk steadily sweeping twigs, looking more bored than busy. The clerk chooses to ignore the old robe, open, exposing a nest of hairs. The entire stock of nails, ponders the clerk, straining against sleep. And boards, gopher wood, all sizes. Ready to repeat the request, Noah, nervous and sweaty, crumples into a small stack of hollow display boxes. Oh God, sir, are you okay? Sir, are you okay, sir? In the morning, Noah pours us both tea. Over runny eggs and lightly burnt toast, he recalls a recurring dream, while I eat and nod, staring at eyes wild with birds.
Eyes wild with birds.
Thank
you. I love that. It's just so, you know, the vision of this guy who's just been collecting all of these animals into the ark. And then he goes in, you know, of course, it's just great to put him in a contemporary setting, going into Lowe's and buying up all the nails.
Where else would you go?
Where would you go? Noah went to Lowe's.
Right.
He stocked up on everything he needed. And I was reading about, there was a study more recently, somebody was trying to, you know, dispel the idea that Noah could never really have collected all these animals. And but I wonder sometimes if there's a partial truth in it, where maybe there were some animals that were collected into this ark, not two of every kind. Or, I don't know, you know, what your faith or what your mind, the different mindset, you know, that you might have on that. But I just thought it was interesting.
Well, the flood metaphor is interesting in itself, and it's always fascinating because it's in every culture. I mean, you have
true.
If you look back, I mean, every culture, and when they were independent and not even really communicating to each other, all have an idea of there being a giant flood wiping out things. You know,
mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a universal archetype in our DNA, I guess.
Right. And this idea of sort of cleansing and starting all over again.
Right.
Did you see the movie, by the way?
No, I haven't. I've been trying to drag my wife to it. But I would love to go see that. I mean, because just the idea of like someone now, you know, doing something from the Bible would be, you know, sort of wild. We would not, you know, someone came along and said, hey, it's going to be a giant flood, you know, we've got to build this ark, or they, you know, let's go do the whole Moses thing. You know, we look at them a little bit crazy, right? So that's always been very interesting to me. Like, you know, people who speak to God nowadays, we think it's crazy. But then, you know, if we look
then
back.
Then it was normal.
Right, you know, according to the book, right?
Yes. I mean, you could have contact with these spirits. And
right.
It was just part of life.
And some guy talking to a burning bush, we would, you know, go,
That's right. And then this, the other idea of the last Jew in Afghanistan, I didn't actually realize it was the last Jew in Afghanistan. I thought it was just kind of the metaphorical last Jew on earth or something, which...
Well, it works on both levels.
Okay.
So, but yeah, he's still there. He's, it was actually interesting because there's a play, and there was him and this other guy, and they were sort of fighting for the rights to be the last Jew to get the attention. Because, you know, a lot of people send money and other donations.
This is a real last Jew.
Yeah, and then this other guy passed away in 2006. His name was Levin, and so now Zebulon is the inheritor of being the last Jew, and there's a little synagogue there, and he sort of maintains it, but it's in disarray, and sometimes he'll open up a store downstairs, like, you know, selling things, and but he stays, and his family has gone on, and over a decade ago, gone to Israel, and sort of left him behind, and he will swear up and down that he's going to die there, so it's kind of an interesting idea, you know.
It's sort of sad, though.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know how many Jews were there. At some point in time, there was a big Jewish community in Afghanistan.
There was. I don't know the numbers offhand, but it's like in the thousands and closer to like the million range at one point in time. And that was, you know, at least over 200 years ago, and then slowly dwindled down to now one.
So are you doing a specific collection on this person, or just... kind of, he comes up as a theme, and you write on him, and he enters in your books.
He comes up as a theme. All the things I mentioned earlier are themes, and it's getting to the point now where they almost all could be their own book. You know?
Okay.
But I have them spread out throughout the book, these three reoccurring themes. Who knows? Maybe there'll be its own book, and we'll see Zebulon in his own thing.
I wonder if it would be nice if he knew you were writing about him, too.
Well, he probably has more of a handout from what I hear. He's more interested in the money. When he's being interviewed by journalists, the first question he asks is how much. You know, so.
I'm a celebrity.
Right.
Give me the money. Would you share that? Well, one of your poems, you have a series starting with one Aliyah. But which one did we choose? Last Jew, too.
It closes the book in The Breath Before Birds Fly.
Okay.
Do you want me to read it?
Yes, please.
Okay. The Last Jew, too, will be born sometime after you read this, with matzah-colored skin and Talmudic eyes, with the breath of a lost language that speaks to salt and ash, begins with Baruch, beginning of a prayer, which most ignore, like the bearded veteran who holds a sign, which could be a board, from the Ark on the corner of Main and 10th. For a few... it would feel familiar, like the moment right before a sneeze, and the bless you, a fraction of a second where you know what will come next, and then it is gone.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
This is from Matthew Silverman's collection, The Breath Before Birds Fly, and it is on, I don't know, the press. But you will tell me.
ELJ. It's a new press that started only a little while ago, and it's really growing fast, and she's doing a really good job over there.
And a really exciting project that you've got going on now. Just the concept of it was just very stimulating and thought-provoking. It's a new, I'll let you explain. I'm sorry.
Well, to take credit would be sort of false. Howard Debs, who is going to be the co-editor, mostly came up with the idea, and it's called Voices from the Salvaged Words, an anthology of contemporary Holocaust poetry. And what we decided to do is we read Susan Gaber's book where she said the Holocaust is dying, and we started thinking about that. I mean, that's, you know, interesting where you have an idea, a moment in time is dying, and it's because the current generations have a hard time connecting to something that happened almost 70 years ago.
Plus, some of the people, the Holocaust survivors, are dying off, like this woman, Alice Summer, which is like 110 years old.
Yeah, there are not many left.
Right. Anyway, go ahead.
No, and that's exactly what we decided to do. We thought about contacting the archives in the Jewish Museum in Prague, getting some photographs, some artwork, some things from the time, and then contacting poets and having them write poems based on the images in the photograph, and then publishing both and seeing what we get.
And this would be known as an ekphrastic type of poetry, work based on art. And just the idea of kind of meditating on some of these documents that they have and so on. I went to Terezin,
by
the way. Yeah, have you been there?
No, I've not.
Well,
it's hard.
And of course, we know that's the center of where many of the children and the artists were in the ghetto and lost their lives. But it somehow managed to be somewhat prolific, putting on plays and composing and so on. So I can't imagine the kind of poetry that could come from meditating on photographs or...
We can't either, but we're pretty sure it's going to be wonderful, and you know, we hope to get that going. We have proposals out to several places now, and then once it gets accepted, we're going to contact people, and then I'm sure it's going to be fantastic.
Are you going to include some of the photographs within?
Oh, yeah, so whatever photograph, we're going to have like a selection of photographs and let the writers choose, and then whatever photographs they pick is what we're going to put in the book, because I feel like that's what's called to them, and then... we're going to reprint the photographs and the images and then also have the poems side by side so you can kind of see
it. Nobody's done anything like this before.
No, it seemed like such
a
neat idea.
An amazing project.
Yeah.
My ears prickled immediately. I was like, oh, yeah, this is...
Well, it won't be out for like another year or so.
It's very, you know, just having experienced it myself and going there and trying to write on it, I'm still tinkering with those poems because, as you know, when you write on such a huge subject... There's an understated kind of approach, I think, almost, that one has to have because the subject is so big.
Right. It's hard. I mean, Poetica magazine put out an anthology of Holocaust poetry in the last few years, but it's sort of like a fine line you have to walk. I mean, to be able to not really go over the top, but you don't really want to go under either. And I don't think there are as many good Holocaust poems because that's such a hard subject.
Right.
You know,
and I think having the images and or the documents alongside it will really bring it, the whole thing, to another level.
That's what we're hoping to do and be like
a leading
point. You can
have amazing readings with that, showing pictures and everything.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm very excited.
Oh, no, great. Well, we got one reader already.
One reader, one purchaser. You don't happen to have any... have you started writing anything on it yet? Or are you kind of waiting for the green light?
We're waiting for the green light, and then we're going to contact through our database of connections the writers and connect them to the photographs. So this is really just in the groundwork stage right now. So there's nothing being produced yet.
I had a friend I went, a poet friend I went to Terezin with, and he ended up writing a pogrom poem called Pogrom. And it won second place in the Anna Davidson Rosenberg Awards.
Oh, yeah, it's a good award that they do.
It was amazing. We went out to San Francisco. It was really nice, actually. Put him up in a hotel, gave him $500.
Wow.
But, the importance of remembrance, I think, is so vital, and your work is bringing that to the public, I think that's, we don't want to forget.
Well, that's what Susan Gaber said in her book. She ultimately said that the way to do it is through writing, through art, connecting through media, through anything digital, to get people to be more aware of something that happened and possibly could happen again.
That's right. And this is one of the vital reasons why we have to keep that in our memory,
right?
Because the generations are leaving, and you can. I've talked to kids, just in casual conversation. They don't even know what it's about,
right?
Yeah. Which is like, this is just a sort of frightening in and of itself. I came across this beautiful quote, which I'll share with you, and then I want to ask you to read your next poem.
Okay.
But it's Borges, and he says, "The task of art is to transform what is continuously happening to us, to transform all these things into symbols, into music, into something which can last in man's memory. That is our duty."
He was so smart, wasn't he?
He's a smart guy. But to transform these memories of, as dark as they are, into art enables it to kind of live on in the future,
right,
in a different way. And also, I think, to process more aesthetically, more privately. I don't know if that makes sense to you. It's not as direct as, I don't know, seeing a film or going to a place,
right,
and having that experience where you can hardly put it into words anyway. Somehow, the art form enables you to permeate the experience better.
Yeah, you can really dive into something more where, you can go watch Schindler's List, but to read the book is a whole different kind of level of experience, and hopefully that's what the anthology will do.
It will. Mm-hmm. It will. You have a beautiful poem which you wrote about your daughter. and that is Mudman, right? Oh, it's about your father and also about your daughter, right?
Yeah, she tends to crop up in a lot of my poems. I was a stay-at-home dad for many years, and my wife went to work, and in fact, she still thinks, even she's 8 years old, and she still finds it weird when other dads go to work, you know, and then the mothers stay home. She doesn't quite understand what they're doing.
Right.
That's the strangest thing she's ever heard. So, mm-hmm. you know, which is a nice viewpoint, I guess, to have. And so I even have like a little chapbook of poems. But, you know, the father-daughter poems, like the Holocaust or like love poems, you know, they're very hard things to write, you know, it's a very fine line.
They are hard to write.
Without being too sincere. Or,
sentimental or whatever.
Right.
Exactly. And how old is she now?
She just turned 8 on April 25th.
You're very close to her.
Right.
Yeah, you have a photograph with her, a beautiful photo.
Yeah, she does crop up in a lot of the photographs you can see online. When you look for Emmy Silverman, you don't just see a photo of me. A lot of times it'd be her in there, too. So definitely a central part of my life.
Does she listen to your poems yet? Is she at that stage where she can...
No, but she's, you know, a wonderful kid, and she cheers on any kind of success without really fully understanding, you know, if I get, like, acceptance or publication, right?
Yay!
Right. This is called Mudman. It begins as a quote, says, "Speak to the earth, and it shall teach you. Needing a father, I create a dibuk of mire and soil and clay, layered with discarded leaves from maple or live oak, with leaves green on one side, packed from the seasoned bones of extinct animals and the rocks my daughter collects. Today we chant our silly song, mud, mud, glorious mud, nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me down to the hollow, and there let me wallow in glorious mud. When I call his name, he bubbles to the top like chemicals in a beaker. When he sees me with my daughter, he scoops her onto shoulders, cloudy as smoke oil, takes us to Italian fields filled with lavender and sunflower. My mud man gives her all, the secrets earth bears, responds to her sound, speaks about puddles, how to walk without breaking twigs, shaping dolls from reeds. He nods with studious attention, shows her where earthworms are born, how termites travel for food, the great gifts of the sun, the wonder at a pond's bottom, the fathomable kingdom of frogs."
Thank you. Fantastic. Thank you for coming to Poets Cafe. Our guest today has been Matthew Silverman. I'm Lois P. Jones. Look for Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on KPFK, Pacifica Radio, for all of Southern California and beyond.